It's time for Ruination Repeat, recapping last week's shows.
I'm not the only one who could use a little bit more of the big fatty.
Oh, dear Gussie, dear Gussie, dear sweet Gussie.
Welcome to this week's Ruination Repeat. I'm King.
I'm Gail.
And I want you to imagine throwing this massive house party where you know, well, for an absolute fact, that half of your guests are just standing silently behind a two-way mirror.
Oh, that is such a creepy visual.
Oh, right. I mean, you can't see them, you can't hear them, but you just know they are watching your every move. And that is exactly the psychological tension we're stepping into today. We are looking at the daily audio records from the week of Monday, June 22nd through Friday, June 26, 2026.
Yeah, it's a really intense week.
It is, because we're looking at a host who is aggressively trying to pull his invisible audience out of the shadows, right? While at the exact same time, he's managing this physical invasion of real-world house guests, technological rebellions, and just a total jarring mix of profound grief and like Sunday afternoon hookups.
It's honestly a study in friction. You have this incredibly carefully constructed digital environment, and it's just colliding violently with the unpredictable nature of the physical world. And what makes this particular stretch of audio so compelling for us to analyze is how the host attempts to assert absolute dominance over both realms at the same time.
Well, let's look at how he attempts to assert that dominance digitally first, starting with Lurker Week.
Yes, Lurker Week.
He officially declares it Lurker Week, though he admits in his classic, completely transparent fashion that he actually meant to announce it the prior week and just, you know, forgot.
Which is so on brand.
Totally. But he is literally imploring the silent listeners to, quote, peep out and make themselves known to you, the audience. He offers up all the classic avenues, right? Sending an e-letter, calling the voice letter number, posting on the www, or pinning themselves on the ham map.
And he even offers this rather hollow reassurance that he won't stalk anyone who actually steps forward.
Right, which is instantly undercut.
Yeah, it's instantly undercut by his own alter ego chiming in to ask, well, what if they're really hot?
Which is just so funny. But I really want to look at the motivation behind all of this. Why is a man who shares such unvarnished details of his daily routine so desperate to quantify these silent strangers?
That's a paradox.
It really is a paradox. Like,
now,
if you are comfortable broadcasting into the void, why do you need the void to stick a physical pin on a digital map?
Well, I think it's because broadcasting into a true void is psychologically unsustainable. I mean, without mapping the lurkers, the audience just remains this, like, total abstraction.
Right, just a download number.
Exactly, just a metric. By forcing them to participate, by demanding they put a marker on the ham map or literally dial a phone number, he transforms that abstract metric into a tangible human presence.
It proves the broadcast has actual stakes.
Yes, it completely validates the energy he is expending every single day.
And the response from the community proves how seriously they take those stakes, too. I mean, the listeners treat the ecosystem with genuine reverence. Take Shyam, for example.
Oh, Shyam's email is fascinating.
It really is. Shyam writes in about a major life move, right? Leaving the penis state, which is Pennsylvania, to go live in a state that observes year-round standard time.
But Shyam isn't just writing in to share a life update. There's this palpable, genuine anxiety about the actual mechanics of the ham map.
Yes.
Shyam genuinely fears that by moving their digital pin to a new state, they might accidentally inflate the listener numbers and end up in, like, BFO jail.
It just highlights the immense perceived authority of the broadcast. The audience literally polices itself to maintain the integrity of the community data.
It's incredible.
And then you have Larry Vader calling in from the jalopy on his way to coal mine renovations. And Larry reports that his neighbor, Haley, could hear the loud man through the walls of his house.
And Big Fatty doesn't miss a beat with that.
Not at all. He instantly demands that Haley delurk. He uses a literal real-world acoustic leak to draft a brand new participant into the digital space.
It really demonstrates the porous boundary between the broadcast and reality. And we also see this with Kristen, who finally delurks after an entire year of complete silence.
A whole year!
Yeah, and she steps into the light to recount this incredibly specific piece of old Vegas lore. I mean, it involves a handshake and a highly memorable bottle of lube.
Oh my gosh, yes.
But it's a perfect reminder of the deep institutional memory these silent listeners are hoarding. They aren't just passive consumers. They are archivists holding on to the entire history of the show.
That institutional memory is such a powerful currency. But I kind of want to pivot from the digital guests to the physical ones, because while he is literally begging people to show themselves on a digital map, the actual physical boundaries of the frugal fortress, the villa itself, are being breached by real-world friends.
Right. The real world intrudes.
Exactly. Alex and Brandon from Carolina Cheese and Provisions arrive to convalesce.
And the contrast there is striking. The invisible audience is invited in, but the physical guests completely disrupt the sanctuary.
Yeah.
Because Brandon is recovering from hernia surgery, right?
Yeah. And the host immediately filters this through his own medical history. He recalls his own past surgery and his very specific request for a doctor with, quote, small hands to minimize scarring.
It's that hyper-pragmatism that always fascinates me. He curates his medical care the exact same way he curates a recipe, which honestly brings us to Brandon's convalescence routine.
Ooh, the drink.
The drink. Brandon adopts this very specific signature drink for his recovery. It's half lemonade, half club soda. He explains that it cuts the sweetness of the lemonade while providing the necessary carbonated sparkle.
And that level of microscopic control over a beverage is exactly what you would expect from anyone operating within the villa's orbit. It's contagious.
It really is.
But while Brandon is hydrating, Alex provides a moment that just totally fractures the fourth wall of our own analysis here.
It was so wild to hear.
Right. Alex is sitting in the studio, observing the intense daily grind required to produce a 20-minute audio record. And he's marveling at the sausage being made. And then Alex looks right at the microphone and directly addresses us.
It is a deeply surreal moment for us, you know, to be listening to a historical audio record and hear our own show called out by name.
Completely surreal.
Alex basically complains that we ignore musicians in our analysis and then brazenly promotes the puzzlemusical.com right over the airwaves.
I mean, as objective observers of the archives, we just have to recognize the sheer audacity of the hustle there.
Absolutely.
Alex uses the host platform to critique the analysts of the host platform, all just to drop a URL. It really illustrates how the Frugal Fortress functions as a nexus for everyone's distinct agendas.
And amidst all these competing agendas and recovering house guests, the host just executes this massive solo weekend culinary flex.
Oh, the menu is unbelievable.
He doesn't just cook dinner. He operates like a four-star general running a military campaign. He prepares baby back ribs in the oven, specifically dictating the low and slow technique.
Naturally.
And he flanks this with a hash brown casserole, corn on the cob, a Southwest chopped salad, and finishes it all off with a key lime pie.
The sheer volume and confidence of that menu is staggering when you consider it's literally just a weekend meal. It projects absolute domestic authority.
I look at that absolute authority and I just have to laugh when I contrast it with the plight of the listener known as Stinkpot.
Poor Stinkpot.
Stinkpot calls in during the same exact week in a state of absolute terror. He left a cooked rotisserie chicken sitting out on the counter for 2.5 hours, and it triggered a full-blown panic attack.
And Stinkpot wasn't just nervous. He was actively monitoring his heart rate and his blood oxygen levels out of a paralyzing fear of foodborne illness.
It is the ultimate juxtaposition. The host is fearlessly slow roasting pork ribs for a banquet, and the listener is strapping on medical telemetry equipment over a room temperature grocery store bird.
So absurd.
It is. So why do you think listeners bring these intensely vulnerable, frankly irrational neuroses to him?
Honestly, because the frugal fortress represents stability. When the host projects total culinary and domestic control, he creates this psychological safety net for the audience.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right. Stinkpot knows he isn't going to be shamed. He knows the host will act as the voice of reason, pragmatically telling him to just put the chicken in the fridge and heat it up the next day. The host acts as the emotional anchor for a highly neurotic community.
I see how the physical control of his environment anchors the audience, but let's kind of examine how he anchors himself, because his emotional environment is just as heavily curated.
Oh, definitely.
Tuesday marks the one-year anniversary of his middle brother's passing. He shares this with the audience, noting that his brother is now reunited with the Hats, which is how he refers to his parents.
The emotional posture he takes here requires immense discipline.
It really does.
He explicitly rejects the conventional performance of mourning. He tells the audience he refuses to be sad, choosing instead to be profoundly grateful that he is alive, specifically so that he can continue to keep his brother's memory alive in his own thoughts.
It's this radical, beautiful form of stoicism, but he doesn't linger in the profundity at all. Almost immediately, he pivots to declaring that they are halfway to Krima, which is Christmas. urging the listeners to start compiling their wish lists.
That whiplash between confronting mortality and embracing the anticipation of crema is the defining rhythm of the broadcast.
And the whiplash only accelerates by Sunday. Out of nowhere, while he is simply trying to watch sports ball, a 35-year-old he identifies as the squeaky gentleman caller texts to come over.
It's completely out of the blue.
Right. The host agrees, they convene at the villa, and they both become, as he puts it, all natural.
And following the encounter, the 35-year-old leaves him with a happy Daddy's Day wish, which is a detail the host admits is ridiculous, but found undeniably charming.
It is completely unvarnished. And the pacing of how he reveals these details is staggering. Like, in the same breath as a Grindr hookup, he launches into his domestic reading habits.
The magazine.
Yes. He's flipping through the July issue of National Geographic, deeply invested in two wildly disparate topics. The prospect of future communities living on the moon, and the mechanics of the smallest post office in the United States, located in the Florida Everglades.
Where he seamlessly incorporates vintage Hanna-Barbera lore, speculating that Wally Gator is likely swimming up to the counter to collect the mail.
Add to all of this a domestic tragedy involving a new hairstylist who completely botched the instructions for a crew cut, resulting in his old stylist being declared dead to me.
It's so much to process in one record.
It really is. And I have to ask you about the architecture of the storytelling, because most of us utilize heavy compartmentalization. You know, we separate our family grief, our sexual encounters, and our trivial complaints about haircuts into entirely different conversational silos.
Right. We filter ourselves.
Exactly. So does throwing the sacred and the profane into the exact same audio file dilute the impact of the grief?
I actually argue it does the exact opposite.
Really? How so?
Well, when media heavily curates emotion-like, when it isolates a sad story and adds a somber soundtrack, your brain instantly recognizes the manipulation. You feel marketed to.
Oh, that's a great point.
But when a man discusses the profound loss of his brother, with the exact same cadence and transparency that he uses to dissect a botched crew cut or recount a Sunday afternoon hookup, it completely obliterates the artifice.
It flattens the hierarchy of human experience.
Exactly. The grief feels heavier precisely because it is sitting right next to the mundane realities of living. It is the raw, unfiltered texture of actual life.
It forces you to take the haircut as seriously as the heartbreak.
It really does.
But holding all of that raw humanity together requires a functioning container. And the machinery holding this universe together was actively rebelling this week. I mean, the meta mechanics of the broadcast were completely under siege.
Oh, the friction begins with the physical environment turning against him. A massive, sudden rainstorm knocks out the power at the villa, forcing him into a completely bare-bones recording setup just to capture the audio.
And even when the power grid cooperates, the software betrays him, he discovers that an automated program called Levelator has been sabotaging the show.
The ultimate betrayal.
Every time he naturally pauses his speech, the software aggressively spikes the volume of the background music, completely drowning him out.
And we only know the extent of this failure because of the spam ambassador, Laughing Buddha, who submits a complaint because the audio mixing was completely unintelligible while listening in the shower.
In the shower?
Yeah. The automation designed to make the production easier actually severed his connection to the audience.
So the host has to literally declare war on the automation. He disables the software and takes manual control of the volume faders, warning the listeners that the sonic landscape they rely on is going to sound fundamentally different.
And the technological betrayals don't stop at the studio equipment. His Apple Snack TV develops a mind of its own, powering on at 2:30 in the morning and forcing him out of bed just to silence it.
He's like a ghost in the machine. And he's getting locked out of his own digital archives, too.
Right, the Plex server issue.
Yeah, he expresses immense frustration that he can't access older seasons of Big Run Northern Mexico. He has to broadcast a distress signal to his tech-savvy listener, Turniphead, begging for intervention to fix his access.
Notice how hyper-aware he becomes of media mechanics when his own mechanics are failing.
What do you mean?
Well, during the same week, he points out the structural changes to the 60 Minutes intro, specifically noting the removal of veteran correspondents Cecilia Vega and Scott Pelley.
Oh, right.
And he sharply critiques the heavy-handed product placement of Fuse Iced Tea on Big Run Canada. He is constantly analyzing how other broadcasts are built, even as his own broadcast threatens to just fall apart.
So here is what I want to challenge you on. Think about the sheer stubbornness required to sit in the dark and keep talking.
It's immense.
When a storm knocks out your power, when your software ruins the file, when your television wakes you up at 2:30 a.m. and your haircut is ruined, I mean, the logical choice is to just take a Tuesday off. What drives a person to push through that much resistance just to deliver a daily record?
I think it's because surrendering to the resistance is an existential threat to the universe he has built. The daily routine isn't just a habit for him. It is the load-bearing scaffolding of his life and his community.
Wow, yeah.
If you allow a power outage or a rogue piece of software to dictate whether you speak, you are conceding your agency to chaos. By sitting in the dark and manually riding the volume faders to record a bare-bones show, he's proving a critical point to himself and his listeners.
That the frugal fortress remains secure.
Exactly. The metronome does not stop for a thunderstorm.
The metronome does not stop. The broadcast is the anchor that holds back the chaos. And as you, the listener, go about the rest of your day, we want to leave you with something to consider about your own ecosystem.
Think about the invisible audience in your own life.
We all have lurkers. There are people in the periphery of your life. An old coworker silently watching your social media, a distant relative who never comments but tracks your every milestone, or a neighbor who notices your routines without ever saying a single word.
They are observing you from the shadows.
What would happen if, just for 1 week, you asked them to step into the light? What would happen if you actively invited the lurkers in your life to make themselves known?
It might completely change how you view your own daily broadcast.
Thank you so much for joining us as we navigated the chaos, the comedy, and the remarkable resilience of this week's archives. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
We invite you to join us right back here for next Sunday's show. Keep your eyes peeled for Wally Gator, and whatever you do, do not leave your chicken out on the counter.
We'll see you next Sunday here on Ruination Repeat.
Thank you for calling. How do you hang the damn thing up?